Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance live from the Kintech Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations or to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. It's the Canucks and the Sharks in San Jose tonight at 7:30. Of course, we'll have the game here on Sportsnet 650. And joining us now, Sharks play-by-play voice, he is Dan Ruzanowski. Dan, thanks very much for making time for us today. How are you?
Great day for hockey. Let's get this thing going.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think now in this era of the San Jose Sharks, always some extra excitement up here when the Canucks play them, of course, because of Macklin Celebrini and his connections here to Vancouver. And, man, what a rookie season he has had so far. How much fun has it been for you just to watch and cover Celebrini day in, day out in his rookie season?
Well, it's been eye-opening. It's been spectacular. It's been a lot of fun, and it certainly has been a pleasure getting to know this fine young man and his family. They have just prepared him so well for the challenge that he has, and he's got a lot of challenges to come, and he's going to have his ups and his downs, but it's been mostly ups. He's dealt with injury already this year, and he has scored some spectacular goals, made some unbelievable plays, and right now, he's the number one center on the team with the deal of Mikhail Granlund to the Dallas Stars just a couple of days ago. So he's getting more responsibilities, and with that comes more attention. And obviously, he's going to always be facing the top D pair on the other side of the ice, regardless of who that is. So it's another challenge for him, and it's been a pleasure to watch it.
Dan, we were having this debate because my co-host sort of set up the game as Will Smith and Macklin Celebrini coming to town. And I took umbrage at that, describing it as William Eklund erasure. What's your thoughts on our tiff? Who gets the decision?
Well, it's kind of interesting because you could add Fabian Zetterlund to that too. I think that William Eklund belongs in that group, as you mentioned, and also Fabian Zetterlund. I understand the thinking about Will Smith and Macklin Celebrini, given that they're both top five picks. William Eklund went seventh overall in the draft, and I think he is really starting to come into his own. Again, that goes back to the tutelage that he was under. Mikhail Granlund, I think, was really, really good for both he and Fabian Zetterlund. But you can't forget about the fact that even though Zetterlund's a little bit older, he's another guy that's still very, very early in his NHL career, had 24 goals last year, and I think that he's having his development issues as well that always happen. But he's really has a bright future, too. But William Eklund is really tough to play against in the corners. He, for his size, he makes the most out of it. He's sharp and he's sneaky with the puck and has a great shot. So I think you have to throw him right in there. And with a whole group of young guys on the Sharks organization now, that I think Mike Greer has done a great job of adding to the total roster picture.
Yeah, when you think about what's happened in San Jose this year and compare it with, you know, I know their record's better, but just the general vibe around the Anaheim Ducks or the general vibe around the Chicago Blackhawks, what's made the difference? What's allowed this Sharks season to be fun in a way that some of the other rebuilding situations that we're tracking in the Western Conference have felt far more like a slog?
I think that it's probably because of the enthusiasm of the last two drafts and, you know, both Celebrini and Smith, deference to putting them together, coming to the team and showing so much promise. But I also think it's just been an attitude with the entire organization, a level of expectation from Coach Ryan Warsofsky. He's teaching, but he's also expecting results at the same time. And the team, very obviously on the ice, is trying their absolute best. And I don't think anybody in San Jose has anything against a team that doesn't necessarily win while giving their absolute best effort. You know, last game against Montreal, that's another rebuilding team that, you know, you're seeing and trying to compare yourself to when you're the Sharks. And, you know, they're a team that it was a hard-working game. They very easily could have won. Came down to basically Montembeau making an unbelievable couple of saves on Macklin Celebrini, of all people, and then coming right down and getting a shorthanded score when they had an opportunity. You know, that kind of thing is going to happen, but it's a learning experience, and it's something that I think the fan base has put their arms around. They understand what's going on here. They're smart hockey fans, and they appreciate the effort, but they also are excited about the talent and what the future is going to bring and what it obviously looks like. And I think that that's a big thing. It's obvious that this team is headed in the right direction.
Have the good vibes or the positivity kind of flagged at all from the beginning of the season? Because, you know, I know sometimes with teams in the situation the Sharks are and they're rebuilding, it's one thing to be that kind of fun, plucky, young team in November and there's a lot of optimism. But, you know, as the losses mount January, February, and the season still has a long way to go, sometimes it can be a little bit tougher, not just for fans, but for the people involved, right? The coaches and the players. Have you seen any of that kind of that drop off in the face of a tough season from the San Jose Sharks?
Well, in terms of enthusiasm, sure. I mean, everybody's a human being, including all of the fans. You know, they have their moments where they get a little frustrated. And the same thing with the players. I mean, you think about that last game, shorthanded goal against in the third period, and when it was looking like, you were pushing as hard as you could to get a victory. You know, I would say that instead of flagging their enthusiasm, I would say that there's a bit of an uptick, but the guys that are in that locker room that are on the team, people like Tyler Toffoli, for instance, he's somebody that gets people together. Mario Ferraro is an enthusiastic sort of a guy and who's been through a lot with his team in the last 5+ years. He's eager to get this thing turned around. And so, you know, I think that the people who have lived through the tougher times, and really last year was a very big low point for this team going through that year when, you know, Mike was basically just tearing down the roster more than he was rebuilding it and acquiring the assets that could get the rebuild accelerated. I think that there's a different feeling this year about that. But I have to be honest, right now, you know, what are we at? Game 56 for the Sharks right mm-hmm. now. So right now, in the next 10 games, I think that maybe getting this break for the Four Nations might be the best thing that ever happened, because then you come back in with a new set of enthusiasm and that stretch drive feeling that teams that are in the playoff hunt have. You almost say to yourself, okay, we're 0-0 now. Let's get this thing going again. And you don't worry about, you know, the past, especially when, you know, your team's components have changed in the last couple of weeks. And maybe, who knows, between now and whenever they freeze the rosters and whenever the trade deadline happens again, that the Sharks might look a little bit different. So I think that maybe that's going to help in that regard.
Yeah, it's a good point about what else they could do before the trade deadline. And, you know, as you said, they've already made sent a couple of veteran players out, Granlund and CeCe going to Dallas. And, you know, one of the interesting things I think is going to be is how Mike Greer balances, well, we're still rebuilding and we need to be collecting all the assets and the draft picks and the young players that we can. But you do want to make sure you have those, you know, the Tyler Toffolis and the other veteran players around guys like Macklin, Celebrini. And ideally, probably the team wants to take a step forward in the standings next year. How do you expect Mike Greer to approach the trade deadline and kind of balance all of those different objectives?
Well, he's very, very analytical in the way that he looks at things. He looks at things of what happens to the team right now, but he's really most focused on how this is going to affect the team in the long term. And so to balance that is important. But he understands the fact that he needs mentors and role models. And, you know, the last time the Sharks rebuilt their team, and I've been here long enough to have lived through all of it, you know, they had young players, and I'll give you a couple names. They had Marco Sturm. They had Patrick Marleau. They had Brad Stewart. They had Scott Hannon. They had Andre Zuzan, a name that some people forget, but they shouldn't. And they had Jonathan Chichu. And that was a nice group of core young players together. But they needed to make some changes to that. They brought in people like Murray Craven and Ronnie Stern and Ronnie Sutter, and they cycled through some of these guys, gave some of them a chance, and I think it's probably slightly changed now with the salary cap and everything else. But, you know, you give those guys a chance to rebuild where they are, and at the deadline, in the case of CeCe and in the case of Granlund, you send them to a team that might very well win the Stanley Cup if all goes right. And so you've treated those veteran players well. What that does is it makes other veterans who might be a free agent and looking for an opportunity to play want to come here. And, of course, you know, you've got the prospect of playing with some of the best young talent in the game right now, with Celebrini and with Smith and with, you know, soon to be Sam Dickinson and several others coming in. So that's another attractive thing, not the least of which is San Jose is a great place to live. So, you know, you have all those things going on, but you have the way that the veterans are treated, I think, is really important, and the way that they're appreciated by the coaches and by the management. And I think that that's something that allows that cycle to continue and allows these players to develop. And then you've got the San Jose Barracuda in the American Hockey League, where you want them to make the playoffs and you want those kids to go through best of seven series against men. And, you know, I know the AHL has best of three, best of five, but you want to get to that point and you want to insert some of those young players into that as well. So those are things that are going on concurrently, and I think that it's pretty exciting, to be honest.
With Granlund and CC moving on, and I know, Dan, you talked about the way that there's been more responsibility on Mac here. One thing that's been noticeable in terms of a difference between this year's Sharks and last year's Washington Generals was the way that, whether it was Wennberg or CeCe or Granlund or Ferraro, like any given moment, Toffoli, obviously, there's like a credible NHL guy with experience who's been in big games on the ice, sort of helping direct traffic, helping out, making the team a little bit more robust, a little bit more competitive night to night. Have the departures of CeCe and Granlund already been noticeable on that front? And what's the message internally in terms of how, you know, Greer and Warsawski want the younger players on this team to respond or step up in this environment?
Well, you definitely notice it, and here's where you notice it. In the case of Granlund, ever since he left, I've noticed that the Sharks, and this goes along with an injury to Nico Sturm and an injury to Alex Wennberg. Those are two guys that need to get back here pretty quickly. They're not ready to go yet. But in the faceoff circle, in the neutral zone, and the defensive zone, the Sharks have had a drop-off. And a lot of that's because of the absence of Granlund to kind of supplement the other guys. And, you know, when everybody is slotted in the right place and taking the draws, you're better off. But, you know, San Jose is, I've seen a drop off in the defensive zone 5-on-5. And you take a look at it last game against Montreal, it was definitely subpar. And the same thing with neutral zone 5-on-5 faceoffs. And those are important times to get possession back. So in that case, in CeCe's case, you see experience on D and a right-handed shot that plays a lot of minutes. And so that means there's more pressure on a young guy like Jack Thompson or Henry Thrun right now. Is playing, he's a left shot playing on the right side of the defense. And he's an intelligent enough guy to handle that and is capable of doing it. But there are moments in the game in which, you know, you have to change your thinking when the puck is coming up on the boards. You're trying to keep it in. You know, sometimes you need that extra second. Sometimes you have to stick your right skate out to keep it in if you're a left shot on that board. And then by the time you gather it, you know, you got a guy or two on you because of the speed of the game. So those are little subtle things that are happening. But the good news is that Ty Dellandrea comes back tonight, and he's going to be taking his share of faceoffs. He wants to be a center iceman in the NHL. He's played a lot of wing with Dallas and with the Sharks. So this is a motivational opportunity for him to add to those faceoff situations, and I think that that's one area where we're seeing it with this team right now. As far as the distribution goes on the defense, you miss CeCe, but you're also excited about the opportunity for Shakir Mukhamudulin and for Jack Thompson to get more playing time at the NHL level. And so far they're handling it okay, but they do display some of the inexperience that you're, you know, naturally going to get. And yet they both make good decisions. Mukhamudulin looks like he's going to be a really solid NHL defenseman for a long time. And Thompson, I think, has surprised some people. He hasn't surprised me because of the type of person that he is. But he's not afraid to get the shots to the net when he has the opportunity. He has a good first pass out of the zone. He just sometimes gets caught in the sort outs a little bit in the defensive zone occasionally because of the speed of the game at the NHL level. So he's adjusting to that, and I think he's doing well. And, you know, all these guys need to, you know, when they get into the NHL, you know it as well as anybody that you have to build up your strength a little bit. You realize how much it takes to get through an 82-game schedule. And we're just getting to all of that as we get into the high 50s in games played, too. So, again, a fascinating time to see all of this unfolding.
Dan, really appreciate the time. Thank you for chatting with us. Enjoy the game tonight.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
That is Dan Rusinowski, play-by-play voice of the San Jose Sharks. And as you said there, he's been around a while in San Jose. Wasn't counting on the Murray Craven reference during the course of that interview. Murray Craven, big part of the 94 Stanley Cup run for the Vancouver
and
Canucks.
Big part of starting up Vegas before he got iced by the Golden Knights.
Was he?
Yeah, he was like the original sort of like hockey focused exec.
Oh, I did not know that.
Part of hiring McPhee, et cetera, et cetera. And then,
well, there you go.
Ultimately ended up getting iced by an organization that is
ruthless organization.
Phenomenally ruthless, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. He brought up,
I think he's still involved in minor hockey out there, though. I think he still had a big impact.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Had a great career, over 1,000 games.
Well, I'd guess going to the Sharks, in Northern California wine country probably is how he knew Bill Foley, I'd imagine.
There you go. It pays off.
Yeah.
Shakir Mukhamudulin, of course, the player eventually drafted in the pick that the Canucks sent to Tampa Bay. And then did New Jersey drafted him?
New Jersey drafted
him. And then they traded him for Timo Meier to San Jose. So bounced around that pick and the player. But the Canucks facing him tonight in San Jose.
A truly fascinating history, I think. When you really look back and consider the JT Miller trade that the original JT Miller trade and all of its component parts. Now, of course, it was JT Miller to Vancouver at the start of day two of the NHL entry draft in 2019 in Vancouver. JT Miller to Vancouver to Tampa Bay, a first round pick, lottery protected year one, could have conveyed to the next season unprotected if the Canucks, the Canucks were doing the Rangers bet. They had to make the playoffs one of the next 2 years. They also sent a third and Marek Mazanich into the deal. Now, locally, it's simply said, like, JT Miller came to Vancouver, was a point-per-game plus player. That was a win. Okay? Well, if it was a win, who lost the trade?
Because you're saying not Tampa. No, they
nobody
won two cups.
Nobody did.
Nobody lost this trade. They traded the pick for Blake Coleman, correct?
So they
was a huge part of their cups.
They end up trading that pick and two additional firsts to build that Yangord-Gaudreau-Coleman line, which was their third line and really a key five-on-five driver as they won two cups.
Yeah.
So Miller's salary for them, which was five and a half, gets reallocated basically to a stud third line and some defensive depth, and they win two cups in a row. They, partly because the Canucks perform so well, trade the first to the New Jersey Devils at sort of lower value than it had when they acquired JT Miller for Coleman. And then that piece is one of the biggest assets that the New Jersey Devils use to get Timo Meier, who's awesome. So it's like this whole thing. There's no losers. Now, again, people look at it simply. JT Miller came to Vancouver, crushed it for 6 years, became this, you know, aging curve breaking two-way cult hero, tough as nails, hard scrabble stud player.
Well, he just
Benning's finest hour.
The easiest way to look at it is he completely changed the perception of him as a player.
Right
there were like
changed the perception of the Canucks as a franchise.
No one thought he was a potential 100 point player when they acquired him. That was just not on anybody's radar.
No.
You know what I mean?
No. He was the winger for Bo.
He was like the complimentary winger for Bo Horvat.
Yeah, and who ended up...
And he slot in on your second line and help Bo Horvat.
Yeah.
That was the conversation.
And he was an awesome bet to do that. Now, I think it was a reckless bet when the Canucks made it, given where they were at their team building cycle. Now, let's go through the history of how the Canucks didn't lose this bet. JT Miller comes in, and after the team has zero juice in their first two games of the season that year in Edmonton and Calgary, respectively, they swap Miller and Michael Ferland. So Miller starts playing with Pettersson and Besser, and that line goes absolutely nuke. Now, that line going absolutely nuke and being the best line in the Western Conference still wasn't enough. The team needed to go on an insane December-January heater driven mostly by the following things. Adam Gaudette and Jake Virtanen with Antoine Roussel on the fourth line started scoring in bunches. Louis Erickson with Bo Horvat and Tanner Pearson were like the eliminator line.
The closers.
Just like killing it with empty net goals. And of course, the team got stud goaltending from Jacob Markstrom. Still, after Markstrom's injury, that team was fading rapidly down the stretch and was fighting for their absolute playoff lives, having fallen out of the top eight in the Western Conference by actual points, but not by...
We all know.
Point percentage, baby! And then the pandemic hit. Now, we all know what happened in the bubble. By eliminating the Minnesota Wild in a three-game series that actually was pretty close, by the way, right? The Canucks locked in and fixed the cost of the Miller deal, handing Tampa Bay whatever it was, the 18th pick, the Shakir Mukhamudulin pick.
20th, maybe, something like that. Anyways.
And as a result, and I wrote it the day they eliminated, the Canucks have won the JT Miller trade. Because the moment that cost was fixed as a mid-teens pick, all it took was an incredible Jake Virtanen and Adam Gaudette heater, the best 3 months of hockey of Louis Erickson's life, and a global pandemic, and then JT Miller becoming a center and flipping his aging curve on its head to get better in his late 20s for the Canucks to win that trade. If all of that has to go right for you to win a trade,
it was
a reckless deal the day it happened.
I thought there was going to be a tie into the here and now. This is just about relitigating the 2019
Absolutely.
Deal.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And by the way, now
I did
that,
not expect
and
that.
And by the way, the total.
I thought there was going to be like, and here's why it's a parallel to this one.
No. I'm just saying now that someone's needed to do this for a while.
Okay.
This is needed to be said for a while, especially after Hockey Night did that. Like, look at all these fans who hated the JT Miller trade. Look how wrong they were. You know, especially or the tweet, not hearing much from critics of Jim Benning now. Like, this organization was so cocksure about a deal where so much had to break their way, including a global pandemic, for it to not be the reckless deal that most of its critics said it was. And the total win for the Vancouver Canucks, 2 playoff series victories across 6 years. Sweet.
They should have made more good moves like that.
Woo!
They should have done more good moves. They should have gotten more good players.
Yeah, you're right. More. They should have done more Oliver Ekman-Larsson type deals, chasing that dragon. Come on.
Yeah, no, that was a bad one.
It was a self-defeating move that failed on its own standards. The team never got out of the mushy middle in JT Miller's tenure in Vancouver.
No, but it wasn't a bad move. Of course it wasn't.
No, because of all the insane stuff that happened.
Yeah, because they got a good player.
No, it would have been a good move if they'd missed the playoffs and given up a lottery pick the next season?
Well, no, because they would have had to miss the playoffs twice, right? But yeah. Potentially still.
Well,
like,
they did miss the playoffs the next year.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. It still could have been a good move. Absolutely, it could have. It's not JT Miller's fault they couldn't put a team around him in his time here.
No, but it's the approach underlined by that trade that kept this team hamstrung throughout. Like, JT Miller's biggest problem as a player in Vancouver was that he wasn't both JT Miller and a top four defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, and by the way, obviously that's not actually his fault.
Yeah, but if you can trade a lottery pick, if you can trade a lottery pick for a guy that turns into that, you do it every time.
Well,
every time.
I mean, sure, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't actually put your team over the top, Jamie, and if you don't actually mind the value created by that level up, then what did you get for it?
Yeah, but that doesn't make the trade bad. That makes all the other stuff you did around it bad. You know what I mean?
But if, like, the trade is indicative of the approach.
But my point is, like, if the OEL one, if they had traded for a 26-year-old or whatever,
no.
They leveled up here, it's like, that's a good trade.
But this is like saying it's when you have a fever, but your heat's broken. So you're like, yeah, but at least I'm warm. Like, at least I'm running at a temperature. It's like, no, the symptom of the disease.
No, it would be more like.
No,
it would
be
more like
you're looking at a symptom and being like, the symptom is good, though. The symptom is fantastic. It's like, yeah, but the underlying problem is that you're sick because you keep thinking this
way. It'd be more like you invested in like a really sick sound system for your car.
Okay.
But the brakes didn't work. You know what I mean? But it's like, well, but it's not.
That doesn't mean you're.
But it's not the sound system's fault. The sound system is awesome.
Okay, but
can you hear this bass? It's rad.
Okay, and fine.
If I'd been as smart as that with the sound system as I had with the brakes, it'd be awesome.
This metaphor is fantastic, but the reason that it falls apart for me was that everyone was like, yeah. Yeah, man. And those idiots over there, like Hockey Night in Canada was like, and those idiots over there said that this car needed new brakes and then the car crashed.
Like, I'm not saying.
And all of the people who were like, yeah, it was a great trade, never have had to be accountable for being wrong.
I'm just saying, don't blame it on the sound system that the brakes didn't work, all right?
No,
that's
all
I'm saying.
I, you know what? I won't. I'm just saying.
And for me, I look
I'm
at
just
it
saying,
as
you
like,
can't tell me that it was a good decision by Toto Wolff to invest in the sound system as opposed to the brakes.
I'm just saying, man, if they'd done the same number on the brakes as the sound system, look out.
No,
look
you
out.
Know what? You I will say, You get the analogy crown for this segment.
Thank you.
You killed that.
Wow, that means a lot.
No, that was fantastic. That was next level.
All right.
Respect.
We'll take a break here. We'll focus on something germane to the present day Canucks.
We'll slam the brakes here.
That's right. We'll slam the brakes.
Oh, no. They don't work. But it sounds so
it
sick.
Sounds awesome.
On my sound system.
Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. More Canucks talk on the other side here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in Step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and it's reacting to our conversation in the last segment. My favorite response from Todd. Todd has bad takes.
So good.
You don't need brakes if you never stop rocking. So true. So true, Todd. Just blast that music. Hope for the best. Pray
Love
for the best.
So much.
All right. You can keep sending your thoughts in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now, earlier in the show, we mentioned briefly Elliot Friedman's report on Carson Soucy, of course, that he's been made available. And then not so much a report as just a note or a musing maybe from Elliot Friedman that Calgary makes sense for Carson Soucy, of course, the Alberta native. Now, one of the complicating factors here is that Carson Soucy has the no trade clause, full no trade clause this year. So he is in control of this process to a certain degree. And it ties into, you know, now that JT Miller has been dealt and there's a lot of excitement, understandably so, about, you know, hey, adding Marcus Pedersen to the defense core and with the arrival of DPD, maybe Villander at the end of the year, all of a sudden the blue line, maybe even an area of strength for the Canucks, or at least a lot better than it looked like earlier in the season. But I think it's fair to say that post JT Miller trade, kind of the big point of conversation when it comes to the future of this Canucks team is the Elias Pedersen, original brand Elias Pedersen, and the fact that his no move clause, and it is a full no move clause, kicks in on July 1st this year. And that sets up a very potentially interesting dilemma for the Canucks because, I mean, we don't need to go down the road of what the heck has gone wrong with Elias Pedersen again. We've spent a lot of time talking about that, trying to come up with theories, all of those things. I think if you were trying to pitch the absolute most optimistic view of things for Elias Pedersen right now, you would say the best case scenario is comes back next year in way better shape and gets back on track. Like, I think even this year is kind of out given what we've seen of the most optimistic scenarios. And we still have people texting in like, can they try this to get him going? It's like, I'm out on all, can they do X this season to get him going? Like, I think that ship has sailed just based on what we've seen. Maybe I'm wrong. Who knows? But I think that ship has sailed. But I think, like, even the most optimistic take on Elias Pedersen at this point involves he has a great summer and he comes back in really good shape. But of course, the rub there is, well, if you're counting on him to have a good summer and that's going to be the thing that turns his performance around, that takes you past the no move clause kicking in on July 1st. And it seems to set up a pretty massive decision and a pretty massive deadline for the Canucks to make a decision before that no move clause does kick in here.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the Carson, I actually think these two situations are kind of linked theoretically anyway, and something that we can get into a bit. So Carson Soucy signed in Vancouver in the summer of 2023. His wife was like 7 months pregnant with twins. He's from Viking, Alberta. His entire family's in Western Canada. He didn't want to go too far up from Seattle, where, mm-hmm. where, you know, he'd found some success with the Seattle Kraken. signs a 3-year deal with Vancouver and gets some trade protection included, given his family priorities. Fair game. I actually thought, first of all, the club's been so high on him for most of his time that I'd sort of interpreted that while frustration was clearly growing with his performance this season, the unevenness of it, I thought he'd have a little more time, a little more rope to work through this.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, no. This organization, having brought in Marcus Pettersson, is obviously happy to jettison a $3.75 million guy who at this point, you know, at this point I'm expecting him, if he were to remain in Vancouver, to like go into next season as like the Phil DiGiuseppe of the blue line. You know, where it's like, if Elias Pettersson's not ready to play full time, if Volander's not ready to play full time, Carson Soucy's like your veteran seven. Well, 3.75, it's not fatal by any means, but it's expensive for a guy who's going to be effectively auditioning for a third pair role. So yeah, the club can reallocate it. They're open to it. Now, he has a bulletproof no trade clause. Has to sign off. No trade clause, of course, is not a no move clause. So if he was too intransigent about it, and if the Canucks were desperate enough to move him, you can always reassign him to the American League and get that good $1.125 million in cap relief that a reassignment would lend you. And look, players don't want to go to the A, right? You want to go ride the bus?
No.
You want to go fly commercial? No, not really. Not if I can avoid
well,
it.
Well, it's a pride thing, too. Like, 100%. It's the logistical stuff, but it's also just like, no, I'm an NHL player.
Yeah, and he is.
Yeah.
He is. Like, big picture, should the Canucks trade Carson Soucy? I think if you can get a return.
Yes.
Like, this is exactly the profile. Like, miserable season. Team's defensive play has fallen off. The team environment's not good. Defensive defensemen often look bad on teams that are flawed and playing flawed hockey. I think that's happened to a lot of Canucks defenders over the course of the year, with the exception, oddly, of Tyler Myers. And because Tyler Myers has often been a victim of this too, right? Where it's like Tyler Myers doesn't make the environment.
Yes.
And in a bad environment, he looks one way. And in a good environment, as we saw last season, he looks another.
Tyler Myers honestly might be one of the most like context dependent players that I've ever seen. How much it can swing when the context is good versus the context is bad is incredible.
Incredible. Well, because, you know, he's a totally good 4-5 guy, you know?
Yep.
He's also up to, by the way, I'm now digressing on a digression of a digression, but he's up to 410 games played as a Vancouver Canuck.
Yeah.
And has this year, and is it three more or two more?
Two more after this.
So, I mean, you're for sure getting to 500.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're probably going to be pushing six at the end of that contract. If he's still good and wants to stay here, like, I don't know, man. I'm just saying we could get to the point where
a third Tyler Myers contract would be incredible.
Are you putting it out of the equation?
No,
you
know, absolutely not. I am not.
Like, couldn't you see
he's
Myers?
He's also incredibly durable.
Yeah, incredibly durable. And couldn't you see him having like one of those Sammy Salo runs?
Where it's like one year.
Just happy here, like it here. I play on the third pair. Sometimes I play higher. Honestly, Tyler Myers is going to be like 43 and they're still going to be giving him like 17 minutes a night.
1 year league minimum for Tyler Myers.
And sorry, I mean just at 5-on-5, because then there's also the penalty kill stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, if Tyler Myers gets like 750 games played for the Canucks, you're starting to have Ring of Honor conversations. And we're not close to that, but we're not that far from it.
That'd be incredible.
Okay, sorry. So back to Soucy.
Anyways.
Soucy's available, and obviously, the team feels pretty confident that they can work with him and another team to facilitate a move like that and probably get something for him, which, by the way, they should have to do. Like, I don't think 3.75 is so onerous for a guy with Soucy's, or 3.25 is so onerous for a guy with Soucy's skill set, especially given his ability to play the right and the left side. And especially, you know, the team's, what the team's desire should be, which is to have competition, make Elias Pettersson earn it, make Tom Volander earn it when they come into camp next year. I mean, you could do a lot worse, and it's not hard to imagine a scenario where Soucy, like, contributes, where injuries pile up, where he's in your top four again, where, you know, you're throwing out a Myers-Soucy pair against tough minutes and he's playing well and his value is higher in 12 months, whether you keep him or not, than it would be today. But more than that, the no trade clause is not this like ironclad chastity belt that can't be broken to prevent you from executing the deal, right? It's something to negotiate around. It's a complication. What it does is it turns a trade from being a two-dimensional exchange between teams into a three-dimensional teams with three parties at the table, all of whom need to agree. The teams, obviously, and then the player. Okay? That's what it does. And I think this is instructive in terms of how we think about Elias Pettersson here, because that NMC deadline that kicks in, first of all, for anyone who doesn't understand why the first year of Pettersson's extension didn't carry an NMC, he's not eligible for it.
Yeah. It wasn't a tactical thing or like, oh, we want to see him prove it. It's just they were not allowed to give him one.
He is not eligible for one until he's eligible to hit unrestricted free agency. If they'd never signed that contract, he'd be going toward unrestricted free agency this summer. This is the first, or next year is the first year in which he's eligible to have it. Just like how Brock Besser's modified no trade kicked in this year because it was the first year that he was eligible for it. Now, a no-move clause is slightly trickier than an NTC because a player can deny a reassignment. And that obviously diminishes a team's leverage. You don't have the bus rides from Syracuse to Binghamton or whatever, or from Stockton to Bakersfield to hold over a guy. And yet, still, a no-move clause is something you can navigate around, something that simply makes your exchange a three-party transaction as opposed to one between two teams. Now, for a player like Pettersson, I do think there's a cost associated with that. Obviously, this is just like basic economics stuff. Like, if a player can limit the number of teams that they're willing to be traded to, that lessens demand, which lowers price. Like, as simple as it gets, Econ 101, right? But when you're a rare enough piece like Pettersson, you still are going to hold a certain amount of value. And in fact, the Canucks just traded a guy with an NMC in JT Miller. Mm-hmm. A pretty complicated situation. It seemed clear that he wanted to go to the East Coast specifically. And yet, whether it was Carolina, the Rangers, and as Friedman reported today, the Avs kicking tires too, there were suitors, there were options, and the Canucks ended up getting a pretty high upside asset, a 25-year-old centerman, and an additional defensive prospect, like a pretty classic hockey trade return for Miller. And that's despite him taking like an unexplained 10-game absence for personal reasons and his issues with a teammate becoming national news for 2.5 months. And they still got value out of him.
Yeah.
So Pettersson going through July 1, through the start of next league year, and having that trade or that no move protection doesn't prevent you from finding a taker, doesn't prevent you from finding a move. It obviously heightens the risk and it probably limits the return. But realistically, we know kind of the teams that would be eliminated when you go past that deadline. And we also, I think, have an understanding that, like, you know, down the line, if it's not working out and you're telling the player it's not working out and their minutes are 10 minutes a night and...
Or you're scratching them playing hardball.
And the team is criticizing him openly in the press and on, like, whether it's L.A., you know, one of the California teams probably remain on the table.
Mm-hmm. Florida.
The original six teams, Florida, most of the low tax state tax teams in good weather cities probably remain on the table. Like, you know, unless you're talking about at the draft, the sort of opinion of Canucks hockey operations that, man, this is our last opportunity to get Byram and Cousins. And we really like them and think that's worth doing, which, by the way, I would not think that's worth doing. Or Josh Norris, because you know that Pettersson's probably not waving to Ottawa.
Right. Unless there's a great...
I don't know that he's looking at that Travis Green reunion. Yeah. I don't know that Travis Green would be either. And sort of batting their eyelashes.
Unless there's excitement. So what you're saying basically is unless there's a home run deal, and not just a home run deal, but on the table from specifically classically undesirable city. So I'm talking Winnipeg's, your Ottawa's, your Buffalo's.
I'm talking Kent Johnson.
Yeah.
I'm talking the best package Buffalo can muster. Zach Benson, let's say. I'm talking Ottawa. Yeah. Unless it's one of those, unless it's a flyover country team. And the risk is that some of those teams go away. And I do think that there's some of those teams that A, would have interest in Pettersson, and B, do have interesting assets.
Yep.
Carolina might be another one, right? Like Carolina, we know that Pettersson obviously signed when the threat of getting traded to Carolina hit the table. So I think that might be a powerful, that might be a powerful team to mention as well in the contender bucket. And do you think Carolina, having pursued him twice over the last 12 months, would not
is
be coming
back at it again?
Yeah, they'll come back at you at the draft, especially if they can't get Rantanen done.
Yeah.
I'd expect that. So more than anything, I just think you shouldn't look at the NMC kicking in as this like ironclad, terrifying deadline. You know, it increases your risk if you hold him beyond it appreciably, but not so severely that you can't figure it out if you have to. And I just watched the speed. Like, Pettersson had the highest speed burst score on this team, according to the next gen stuff, like 23 plus miles per hour, just 2 years ago. And now he's one of the five or six slowest guys on the team. In fact, he hasn't hit a max speed burst higher than Brock Besser this year. I don't know, man. I'm just watching this guy try to stride and try to generate power with his stride. There's no quickness in his game. I'm not saying it's all physical. I'm not saying that there's not a mental component or a classic performance component to whatever he's going through, which, you know, I can't speak to directly. But I struggle to imagine that there's not some physical component of some order.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, and I brought this up on Halford and Bruff this morning, if you go like deeper into the numbers and look at when his like top speed bursts and top shooting speeds happened, it was like all in the first 2 weeks of the season. Like everything was the first couple weeks.
Hmm.
And now we haven't seen him get close to that level. So given that it's across the shot and the, I struggle to imagine that you're going to get anything that even looks like Apex Pettersson or feels like progress or even like the guy getting back to it without a break. Now, he's going to play Four Nations, but maybe that helps. It's going to be a less truncated
schedule
anyway.
For sure, yeah.
Maybe that helps. Maybe that time off helps a bit. Hopefully, it's something that's not physical, and he can work through it during the break or being around his countrymen or have some success there and get his confidence back, if it is, in fact, something like that, which I kind of doubt. But I do worry that this team traps itself if they're looking at that NMC deadline, like that NMC kicking in is this like massive, overwhelming pressure point that they have to be reactive to. Like, we have to see more down the stretch. Otherwise, the draft's when we have to do this. I think if you're looking at it that way, you're setting yourself up to make a mistake. I think this guy's going to need more time than that. And I understand if that risk is too large. I'm not saying that there's a right or wrong way to approach this necessarily, but if you believe in the player and if you think you can work with him, and if you look at the vultures circling above the Canucks interested in acquiring the guy and read between the lines of why they do so, you know, I think it's a risk worth taking, given that while I like what this team's built on the blue line, and I like the structure that they play with, like I believe in Rick Tocchet as a head coach here, you're not going anywhere without some dudes. And if Pettersson's not one of them, and he has been in the past, I don't know how this club grafts the elite talent required onto what's now looking like a pretty well-built blue line to get going anywhere meaningful.
And I suppose the risk beyond the idea that like, oh, we're stuck with him now, we can't trade him, it would be impossible, is also that like we haven't seen his value really decline a lot to this point. But if he comes back next year and then all of a sudden you're getting to January and you're talking about like two calendar years without having seen the best of the player, like at a certain point, that is going to dent his value. That is going to start to play into things and maybe reduce the number of suitors and all of that. So there is risk there, even though I agree with you that there are ways around the no move clause. You can still probably get out of it if you have to. The way I've been thinking about the decision at this point is, as you said, look, this team, I think we all see a lot of positive signs around the blue line. They've got some flexibility, you know, Lekker-Mäki, all those things. There's some good things happening. You need an elite forward. And I mean, I don't mean like a good first line forward, like an elite forward. You absolutely need that.
If you don't have a dude, you are dead in the water in this.
So here's what are like assign a number, a percentage of likelihood that you think Elias Pettersson is going to be that player, is going to come back next year and be that player, or at least immediately start progressing towards being that player. Who knows what percentage that is? But let's say like let's say it's a 5% chance. Okay, that's a pretty negative assessment. I would say that there's a 5% chance. If you trade Elias Pettersson, you have to go find that player in another way. You have to go find that elite player in another way. And what's the percent chance that you're able to do that in this window with Quinn Hughes under contract, with, you know, Filip Hronek and Marcus Pettersson at their ages still at the peak of their abilities? You have to do it not just like in the future, not just, oh, well, we're going to draft a guy in 5 years. He's going to be that for us. You have to do it in the here and now. And what are the what's the percentage chance of you doing that? It's probably less than 5%. So you're in this situation again where there's no clear slam dunk answer because the downside on both ends is really significant. The downside of Pettersson never finding it again, which is becoming more and more likely as every game goes by, I think it's fair to say. That's really significant. But the downside of trading him, and I'm not even talking like you trade him and he goes off somewhere else. I'm just purely talking about you trade him and then you need to replace it. You need to go find on the trade market your stud number one center. That's really, really difficult to do. It happens. Jack Eichel trade. But the stars have to align for you to be able to do that. So I think where I'm at is, even if you think it's like a 5% chance that Pettersson bounces back, that's still probably better than crossing your fingers and hoping another one comes available and you're able to go out and land them and bring them in and that you can make it work. Like, unless you think it's zero, unless you think it is over, he's not coming back, it's absolutely done, I think the path that gives you the best chance of getting a stud number one center is cross your fingers and pray. Keep him, cross your fingers and hope that he comes back better.
No, but don't design a program.
Sure, but you know what I mean.
Figure it out. Like, use science.
Pray that your science and your program gets it done.
Sure, but also don't pray at all. Plan for it. Like, maximize your star player. Maximize your star players. Like, that's it. You know, and look, the best of the best obviously go out and seek help themselves, right? Quinn Hughes completely reimagined what he could be as an attacking player. And it's a... You know, that work with Daryl Belfry, which I've spotlighted at length. I mean, direct link between that and the, you know, 15-goal dominator that we see today, right? Partly it's on the player, but in this world, in this league, in a world where goaltenders are only saving 900% or 90% of the shots they face, like, you need to find ways to make your star players the absolute apex versions of themselves, and that's on the club. Like, that's on the club fundamentally. Like, if you don't think you can do it, or if you don't think he's the right receptacle, the right guy to pour that organizational heft into, then I get it. But you have to be approaching this as like an organizational goal, because you're not getting a number one potential franchise center, the sort of guy who can put together 112 points across an 85-game sample the way he did in the calendar year prior to what the struggles that we've seen the last 12 months, which, by the way, 57 points in 80 games now.
Brutal.
Not good.
Just brutal.
But a crazy fall off. Like, we're still only 12 months removed from that guy.
Yeah.
You got to be able to figure out what it was. Like, if you want to win a cup with Quinn Hughes' prime, you've got to figure out how to get the Pettersson from 2 years ago back.
Rewind the clock.
And everything has to be about that. And if that's not something you think is feasible, if you're waving the white flag on that, like, then you are waving the white flag on it. Like, you know what I mean? You are materially accepting.
Well, that's what I mean. And I think people like take this as like, oh, you're defending Pettersson. I am absolutely not. Absolutely not. 5%? That's a horrifically negative take. That there's a 5% chance that he bounces back next year.
Well, I mean, do you actually believe that?
I don't know. I don't, like, I wouldn't fault anyone who believes it.
No, I wouldn't.
You know what I mean? Like, with the evidence we have available
to
us?
I don't know. Like, I don't know what's going on, so I don't know how likely it is that he bounces back.
That's the thing. It's like, who knows what even the range is. But if someone was like, I feel really bad about this, I'm saying 5%, it's like, okay, that makes sense. Well, but, like, my point is, even the really, really negative prediction is still probably better than, like, well, hopefully the next Jack Eichel decides to come to us.
Was Andrew Walker actually right?
He's an AHL guy.
No. I think the answer is no.
Yeah. Anyways, it's the whole point about, like, man, what happened? What actually happened? What is the diagnosis? What is the theory of the case here? Is so baffling and so fascinating. And I don't know if we're ever going to get a real answer onto it, because, man, it is it's one of the most baffling things we've seen, certainly in Vancouver, in the NHL, to see a player drop off like that from one 12-month span to the next. We'll take a break here. Keep your thoughts coming in, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Brendan Batchelor, voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650. He joins us next on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Tom, JanPro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit janpro.ca. Now joining us ahead of tonight's game between the Sharks and the Canucks in San Jose, he is the voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, our pal, Brendan Batchelor. Batch, what's going on, man?
Not too much. How are you guys?
Batch, you're the only man who talked to Rick Tocchet on a game day today. What can you tell us about what we can expect tonight?
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see when they hit the ice for warm-up in terms of specific lineup things. I can't really speak to those at this time, but this is a group that, you know, played a pretty good game last game against the Avalanche. They were much improved against the Red Wings, and we'll see what they've got in store for us tonight against a San Jose team that they should be beating.
The Canucks yesterday, last night, announced that they signed Marcus Pettersson after only a couple of games with the team to a 6-year extension, $5.5 million AAV. And as mentioned, look, it's just a couple of games with the Canucks, but what stood out to you so far? And, you know, I know he spoke to the media today on Zoom as well, so kind of off ice and on ice, what stood out to you about Marcus Pettersson so far?
Well, some of the things we've been hearing coming out of the room about how he's already sort of taking a leadership role, and, you know, he's chatty on the bench and says things in the dressing room. That to me speaks to a guy that is incredibly confident in the person he is and the player he is. And the player he is has been pretty great for this group thus far as well. It feels like some much needed stability, especially, and again, like, I don't think we can make this point enough. The Canucks have done a great job of driving play over two games against teams that are in the playoffs right now, or at least the last I checked, the Red Wings were still in the playoffs. And they managed to drive play both of those games without Quinn Hughes. And I think Marcus Pettersson and some of the stabling presence that he has brought on the back end is a big part of that. Not to mention, you know, Elias Pettersson stepping up into a pretty key role, or you know, making the most of his opportunity anyway with the chances he's been given. So, you know, good stories all around on that back end, but I don't think it was entirely surprising that, you know, this hockey club was going to commit term and money to Marcus Pettersson. They clearly valued him very highly based on the fact that they gave up that first round pick they got from the Rangers. And he does feel like the right defenseman at the right time for this team in terms of settling things down on that second pair and giving them some more consistent minutes beyond Quinn Hughes and Philip Hronek, which is basically what we've been talking about since Drantz and I were hosting shows together in July about, you know, whether this team would have enough depth and enough puck moving ability on the back end. And, you know, one of the points I made in the summer was, you know, the group that starts the season won't be the group that comes out of the trade deadline.
How right you were.
Clearly,
how right you were.
I was going to say, I didn't know how right I was. I don't think I was thinking about a JT Miller trade when I said that in July and August when we were doing those summer shows. But, you know, maybe I should go into palm reading or something like that. There you go.
Honestly, every Canucks season, I feel like the crazier your off-season take, the more likely you were to hit the nail on the head. You know what I mean?
Think about how many years, like, people, not just us, but, like, generally people are like, I think they're going to be right on the playoff bubble. And it's like, no, that's wrong. They're going to have the most incredible season ever, or it's going to flame out. It's going to be a disaster.
Yeah, like, if you'd gone on Vancouver radio in July and said, I think things are going to get so bad in that locker room that Pedersen and JT Miller are going to have a well-publicized beef that causes both to be on the trade block, with the club ultimately trading JT Miller. Can you imagine what the inbox would have looked like? People would have been so furious.
People would have been laughing at me. I would have been laughed out of town. And to be fair, my take was not very outlandish. It was just like, hey, let's wait and see. They're making a bet on Desharnais. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. I know they missed on Zadorov and people are worried about that, but if it doesn't work out for them, then they've got time. Jim Rutherford makes moves. They'll be able to do things to tweak around the edges. But I thought those tweaks were going to be around the edges. So the fact that it's, you know, been to the core group and had such a massive change for this roster is surprising to me. Should be surprising to anyone covering this team. I'd be willing to bet that in an honest moment, it would be surprising to JT Miller and Elias Pettersson themselves as well. So I think that's sort of a reflection of how far this season went off the rails. But yet at the same time, here they are tied for the last playoff spot. So off the rails, even for this group, wasn't as bad as it felt at times during that whole 2 month long soap opera.
Yeah, that was a pretty wild time, no doubt about it. Now, so and the interesting thing is, right, the Pettersson acquisition, Marcus Pettersson, kind of feels like something they would have done anyways. You know, like if you had sat down in the summer and really done the exercise of, okay, which defenseman could they potentially acquire here before the deadline, I think Marcus Pettersson would have ended up at the top of a lot of people's lists, given, you know, pending UFA, connections to Pittsburgh and all of those things. The other side of the transaction, the JT Miller one, really the big shock. And they bring back Filip Hedl as part of that, who gotten a big opportunity, played a lot of minutes, and has looked pretty good in just a couple of games with the Canucks. And, you know, with this new look forward group minus JT Miller, and with Elias Pettersson still not producing and anywhere near the clip they need him to, I mean, I feel like there's going to be a lot of opportunity for Filip Hedl to play big minutes and in some pretty good situations here down the stretch.
Yeah, he set a season high for minutes in the game against the Red Wings, and then he set another season high for minutes in the game against the Avalanche. So I think that that tells you what Rick Tocchet thinks of him. It tells you the impact that he will be capable of having on this roster as long as he can play to the level that he has played to through two games. And again, it's a small sample size. He's excited to be joining a new team. He's going to get more opportunity. We'll get a better read on him when we come to the end of the season and look back and see what the production and the deployment and all those things were like down the stretch run in the final 30 games of the year or so. But thus far, I think he's been better than advertised, or better than I thought he would be, filling a top six center ice role, to the point that, you know, to your point about, you know, Elias Pettersson struggling to produce still, and you know, that line with him and DeBrusque and Besser struggling to drive play, and ultimately they were broken up during the last game. Hedl is essentially being deployed as your number one center right now, and, you know, it's two games, so I'm not going to draw sweeping conclusions, as I said, but through two games, you know, I don't have a lot to nitpick in his game. I'm sure there are some defensive things that they'll want to work with him on. And ultimately, his two-way game is more likely to dictate how Rick Tocchet, or how much Rick Tocchet trusts him, than, you know, whether he scores 20 goals the rest of the way this year. But I do like the bet on Hedl from the perspective of getting a guy who couldn't punch through a ceiling in New York with the guys they had on their top two lines, and seeing what he can do given increased opportunity. Because, you know, I think back to the original Vegas Golden Knights and how much success they had with a team full of guys that you could describe by like that, whether it was William Karlsson or Jonathan Marchessault or whoever you want to think back from that original Golden Knights team. They used the expansion draft and they used their leverage to acquire guys that they thought had high upside that hadn't realized it yet. And they made some very smart bets, and it worked out for them very well. So you do wonder if Filip Hedl, who has never really been a top six centerman in the league, with a new lease on life in Vancouver, with new opportunity, with increased ice time. Can he develop into that? I guess we'll wait and see. But thus far, it's been a good find for the Canucks, and we'll see if he can continue to perform and extend his two-game point streak as a member of this team when they face the Sharks tonight.
You hit the nail on the head there, I think, with especially that age range where it's like you've been around, you played, you know, 200 to 400 NHL games, and, you know, like the Wild Bill Carlson glow up where, I mean, I guess this is more analogous to the bet the Flames made with Morgan Frost, where it's like John Tortorella doesn't have enough time for a really good young center. But, you know, Hedl went through it with Gerard Gallant, right? Was played down lineup. Gallant doesn't like young players, doesn't work to develop them, right? Really turns his room and his team over to the vets. And then I think Peter Laviolette has some of that DNA in him as well, albeit with a little more structure and detail than Gallant. I think you're onto something where it might be over time, over the remainder of the season, I think we may see the seams show, and maybe Hedl's not a top six caliber guy, but there's absolutely a chance that he can be more in Vancouver than he was in New York.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're also grading him on a curve right now against the current forward group and how much they've struggled. So, you know, if the team can get going and get back to playing the kind of hockey that they can and some of their top players can produce again, then maybe he doesn't stand out quite as much. But, you know, it's interesting you talk about, you know, coaches that didn't necessarily want to trust young players, because I think in some ways you could describe Rick Tocchet that way, right? You look at Nils Höglander and Andrei Kuzmenko and how they struggled under this coach. But to me, that's less about young players and more about buy-in and more about, can they play the game that he requires his players to play, and can they adapt their game to be reliable at both ends of the ice in order to gain his trust? And, you know, even he admitted, Tocchet did, that, you know, Hedl, there's still some defensive zone coverage things to work on with him. So ultimately we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, for anyone that would think that about Tocchet based on, you know, the trajectories of some of the younger players that have played under him here, I would challenge you to look at what he's doing with Elias Pettersson right now, and how they've talked about how carefully they want to develop him and how impressed they are, but they're giving him small bites and they might increase his zone starts, you know, in response to the question you asked the other night, Drancer, about, you know, not getting the D zone starts to this point. But you could tell they're excited about Elias Pettersson. And so, again, he's a different case. He's a defenseman. He's, you know, 5 years younger than Hedl. But it shows you that Rick Tocchet is willing to put trust in guys that he believes in and who buy into the way that he wants to play. So, you know, I've said this, like, it's like I could record myself saying this and play it on almost every interview I do on this station, because I said it about Goldobin, I said it about Virtanen, I said it about Höglander, like, you know,
Podkolzin,
Kuzmenko, Podkolzin, go down the list. You either have to be a 200-foot forward that can play the game and be reliable in your own zone to be effective in the NHL, or you have to score so much that coaches will overlook your defensive deficiencies. And so that applies to a guy like Hedl as well, who, you know, I think certainly has the potential to have a strong two-way game, and I haven't seen anything that greatly concerns me through a couple of games, but that's going to be the pathway for him in terms of trust with Rick Tocchet as well. Either you score so much and you produce so much that it's like, well, you know what, if he's a little soft on the back check or if he doesn't get back onto the rail every time, we'll let it slide because he's scoring 30-plus goals a year or whatever it might be. Either that, or you've got 100% buy into the way he wants you to play. And either of those ways will get you trust and opportunity and ice time. But it can't be a middle ground where you're not producing enough and you're a defensive liability out there as well. And that's what cost, among other things, guys like Goldobin and Bertan and Kuzmenko their spots in Vancouver ultimately.
You mentioned DPD Elias Pettersson coming up, and, you know, kind of feels almost like a new acquisition to the organization as he's making his NHL debut at the same time they make all these changes and bring in some new faces. But man, what a pleasant surprise he's been in, and really just a treat to watch so far in his tenure with the Canucks. And you mentioned, you know, the care that Rick Tocchet is taking and how he's spoken about the development plan for DPD. But has he kind of done enough to at least for now, earn a permanent spot in the lineup for the Canucks, even once Quinn Hughes is back at some point?
I'm not there yet. And the reason is, we've already heard about Soucy's name potentially being out there on the trade market. But now there's Quinn Hughes, there's Marcus Pettersson, and there's Derek Forbert ahead of him. And Forbert, as much as he's had injuries and you know, other issues and been in and out of the lineup this year, is a big PK guy for them. He'll become a more important PK guy for them if Soucy is either traded or not in the lineup on a night-to-night basis, because Soucy leads the team in shorthanded ice time this year. So, you know, I like a lot of what Elias Pettersson has done this year. I think there's a very positive arc there for him in terms of development. I think he's a guy that will be in the mix going forward and should be in the mix going forward. But assuming a fully healthy blue line, I don't think he's cracking it on the left side above those three guys. And at that point, why are you keeping him in the NHL to be a seventh or eighth defenseman when he can go back down to Abbotsford and play big minutes and continue to develop and grow his game down there? So, you know, I understand the excitement around Elias Pettersson, and look, he's a, I think there, it's not a coincidence that in the same week that he kind of has his coming out party at the NHL level, that we hear Carson Soucy's name being thrown out there on the trade market. I think they're very comfortable with the depth they've got on the left side with Marcus Pettersson coming in and Elias Pettersson showing well. But I still don't think he's done enough to get into the lineup on a night-to-night basis over a guy like Derek Forbert. I guess the interesting question then would be, has he done enough for them to consider moving Forbert to the right side like they've done with Soucy here, to get Pettersson in the lineup? Or are they not quite at that point yet when they've got, you know, options on that right side, whether it be a guy like Noah Juulsen or a guy like Victor Mancini, who we haven't even seen play at the NHL level in Canuck colors yet either?
The thing about what we've seen out of Elias Pettersson, and I think, you know, like with Filipetal, the question is going to be sustainability, right? Like, they've made a positive first impression. Let's let it shake out for more than two games before we go overreacting to anything. But this team's been generating shots with Pettersson on the ice, Elias Pettersson, in a way that they don't with really any of their other defensive options. If that continues, man, I don't see how you can take him out of the lineup for a guy like Forbert or Soucy, just given how little juice this team has offensively.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, in that scenario, Quinn Hughes is back in your lineup. And the only real good sample size we've had of DPD has been without Hughes over the last couple of games. And, you know, I don't disagree. I think he's been very good. I think that's, you know, a big part of why he's gaining the trust and why the ice time's going up and the opportunity is going to increase and all of those things. But ultimately, now that you've built out a top four that looks like a pretty good top four with Hughes, Hronek, Myers, and Marcus Pettersson, that third pairing to me, the priority is going to be more situational, right? It's going to be penalty killers. It's going to be guys that can play shutdown minutes. It's things like that. And because of how cautious they are being with his development, I don't know if they would want to give him that big of a responsibility right away. And, you know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing either. I know, you know, he, again, you're right, small sample size, so we don't want to read into it too much. We'll see how things trend. And there's plenty of young defensemen that have come up and had a good three or four or five games running off the adrenaline of the opportunity to play in the NHL. And then their game dips again and they need to go back to the AHL and continue to work on things. It's not the worst thing to have to go back to the AHL and play and continue to grow your game and work on some of those things. You know, I totally understand. If he continues to play at that level, I think he'll make their decision more difficult. But ultimately, because of the penalty killing roles that some of those depth guys can play, because of, you know, Tocchet's likely preference for veterans in some of those minutes where guys might be pushed into matchup situations, or just he wants guys he's comfortable out there on the ice if they get caught on an icing and the other team's top line comes over the boards or something like that, it wouldn't surprise me if Elias Pettersson goes back to the AHL at some point this year. But I don't think that happening would be an indictment of him or his development or of his play. I think it just probably speaks to some added depth on the left side and some more veteran options that can be trusted in certain situations that they might not want to throw him into that deep end right away. And they don't have to throw him into that deep end right away with how they've built out their depth on the left side in particular.
Batch, always appreciate the time, buddy. Have a great call tonight, man.
Sounds good. Thank you.
That is Brendan Batchelor, voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650. He'll have the call tonight, 7:30 puck drop against the San Jose Sharks. You can hear it here on Sportsnet 650. A couple minutes before the end of the show, wanted to pass along an update here, an update of sorts anyways, on Quinn Hughes' status, and especially for the Four Nations tournament, which gets going next week. This is from our colleague Ian McIntyre on Twitter. Says, Canucks hope to see Quinn Hughes play Saturday against Toronto, but it's largely the captain's call for Team USA at Four Nations. And then he has a quote from general manager Patrick Alvin. Quinn is extremely professional. He knows his body and what he can do or not do. So I trust him a lot. We're supporting him in his position. As we talked about on the show yesterday, when you think of the weight Quinn Hughes has in this organization, what he's done for the team on the ice and off the ice, it was always going to be very difficult for them to take a tack different than this. They pretty much had to do this, say, look, Quinn, it's your decision. We're going to support you. And that's what Patrick Alvin comes out and signals here today as well. It's going to be his decision, and they trust him and they support him, whatever he decides to do. Makes a lot of sense.
Quinn, here's the keys. You want to have a party this weekend while we're away? You have a party, bud. We're the cool dad.
No, I don't think it's that. As I think it was Bruff who said on the morning show today, it's like, there's, you're dealing with a teenager. There's good teenagers and bad teenagers. There's good teenagers, it's like, we trust you to have a few friends over. Not, and it's not going to get out of hand. We're going away. You do you. We trust you. We're giving you that ability. The bad teenager, you don't. You say, no, you can't do it, right? Quinn Hughes is the good teenager, as Bruff was saying, where it's like, we trust you to make the right decision here.
Yeah, but there's also a competitive element where you're like trying to be the cool parent in the wake of a divorce. Like, choose me. Pick me, man. Pick me. Whether you're a good teenager or a bad teenager, you do you, bud.
Yeah, but Quinn Hughes, we all know, is a good teenager.
100%.
Just really wants to go to the Four Nations, understandably. They don't play till Thursday, though. So, you know, still a week away.
Yeah, he's got some time.
What's basically been a day-to-day injury situation.
Well, I guess. We didn't see him on the ice yesterday. That's didn't true. Travel with the team today. He looked miserable at the end of that Dallas game. He tried to play but couldn't. I mean, I don't know. It also looks like his hand is held together with a Phantom of the Opera mask. Like, guy is going through it, man.
He absolutely is. And I just hope for his sake and for hockey fan's sake that he is able to play healthy, no problems, full speed at the Four Nations.
Anytime Quinn Hughes can remind the hockey world that he's the best player or the best defender on the planet, I'm all for it.
All right, that is the show for today. Again, Canucks and Sharks, 7:30 tonight here on Sportsnet 650. We will be back tomorrow to break down the game. Kevin Woodley and Dmitry Filipovich will join us on the show tomorrow right here on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford.
And Jason Bruff.
Join us for Halford and Bruff in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.